Latino Stories, Historias Latinas, es un podcast que nace del proyecto de narrativas orales de latinos en Ohio, Oral Narratives of Latinos in Ohio, con entrevistas en español, inglés, and Spanglish. Welcome to Latino Stories. I'm Elena Fallis. My guest today is Kena Ulloke Ichakiak. Is an assistant professor of professional and technical writing at Virginia Tech University, who focuses on empowerment, social justice, indigenous advocacy, and equitable research practices. She is an Inupiaq from Northwest Alaska and an enrolled member of the Nordvik Native community. Welcome to the studio and to San Antonio, Kena.
Thank you so much, Elena.
Kena, what languages did you grow up speaking and hearing?
So I grew up speaking primarily English. I grew up in a combination of both Northwest Alaska and California. But what I heard in my home, so my parents were all, like, they had a heritage language other than English. Mm-hmm. So my mom spoke Inupiaq as her first language. My adopted father spoke Azukipin, which is Siberian Yupik, as his first language. My biological father spoke German as his heritage language, and his wife spoke Cantonese. Mm-hmm. So in my growing up, I heard a lot of those languages in the home and among, like, relative groups, but I wasn't taught any of them in a formal way besides, you know, I can pick up, like, being scolded in all of those languages. And then I could also, you know, pick up on, you know, like, bad words and also, all, you know, all the things that you learn how to pick up. And then I also grew up hearing a lot of Spanish growing up as well, so in particular, you know, just in California.
Yeah, great. Did you think much about the literacy practices of your community growing up, or, you know, especially hearing all those languages that you just mentioned?
I think as an adult, and in just the last few years, it's the only time I ever really thought about literacy. It's like this as a professional, is when I've been thinking about how do we know what we know, and how do we document what we know, and then how do we transfer that? Mm-hmm. And so that's where I'm coming from as a literacy. But when I think about my people, in particular, so I'm Inupiaq, even though my adopted father is Yupik and my biological father is German, I identify just as Inupiaq, because that's just my worldview lives there. But, you know, in thinking about my people up in Northwest Alaska, our literacy practices, we didn't really have a written language until the 60s-ish. And that's when people were translating the Bible, right? Like, people, missionaries came to translate our language into a Bible. And then from that, they gave us a dictionary of our language. And but it hasn't ever really been much of a written language. It wouldn't be something that people would write down in either syllabics or using letters that we know today. But I do have images that my mom gave me of my great-grandmother, so my mom's grandmother, Matulik. When she would go to church, she would write down what she was learning about the, you know, God or whatever. And it was in hieroglyphics. Mm. And so it's kind of gorgeous to look at. And it had Matthew, whatever. Right, you know, so I'm reference. Like looking at the, and I'm trying to, so, you know, that's some, I know that was a literacy practice, but our people weren't sitting there like writing down our language. It was primarily an oral tradition. Mm-hmm. But I knew that I had a lower understanding. And I had a lower uptake because I didn't understand even just how our language was, the grammar of it, the basics of it, because it's so different from English grammar. And I understand that today. But, you know, I often faulted myself for not being able to pick it up better, even though I heard it so much. And I have to, you know, I realize that today the languages are, like, so different that I grew up with that, you know, and that I just didn't have the opportunity to feel good about what I did know. Mm. You know, so the literacy was, I always felt like incredibly illiterate. Mm. But I've learned today with a lot of work that I actually do have a lot of cultural literacy, right, which might not be embedded or tied directly to a language use, mm-hmm, but that it is interconnected with my language.
Absolutely.
And can help me to become a speaker, you know, more than just somebody that understands a little bit.
Right. So we recently hosted a woman from Oaxaca, Mexico, and she spoke about the work that she's doing with the Zapoteco language. And one of the things that she said was that, similar to you, right, primarily an oral language, but now they have like the written form, and also how much visibility they're trying to make people aware of, right? So, for example, there are signage in Zapotec. And people, she says, my own people don't read it as much. Like, they don't notice it, but we're making them, you know, really think about what that means, right? Because they're decolonizing the space that has been primarily Spanish, right? And so those, for her, those are signs, right, that they're having in their community with the Zapotec language, you know, signage everywhere. So I thought that was really unique, and especially in languages, most, you know, indigenous languages that have been passed down orally primarily, but now there is this urgency really in rescuing and like teaching our next generations, right, this languages, or like many have the risk of dying, right?
Yes, my language is classified as a severely endangered language, mm-hmm, and it is absolutely something that's in the front of my mind as a scholar, but mostly as an Inupiaq and as a parent and maybe one day a grandparent.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So we know that many groups, including indigenous groups, communities around the world, like I mentioned, you know, this woman from Oaxaca, Mexico, and Spanish speakers in the U.S. have experienced linguistic violence by limiting, stigmatizing, and erasing people's languages, right? How do we continue to do this work, you know, to keep the languages alive, the work of reparation and healing in our classrooms and with our students? How are you seeing or envisioning or doing this work yourself?
So for me as an instructor, you know, I realize that for me, I don't know the experiences walking into the room or coming into the room with the students that I have. Mm-hmm. I have a racially coded name that look, you know, it's like it gives native, or it gives, you know what I mean? It gives like, she might be a BIPOC scholar or something like that. So I teach social justice type classes or justice-oriented courses. And so I attract a lot of underrepresented and minoritized students in my courses, like a pretty high rate for teaching at a primarily white institution. And so I recognize that possibly coming into the rooms with these students is a history of linguistic violence, right? Of colonial violence, of racial violence. And so I try to offer space in our rooms to acknowledge that. But I also, like, I recognize that there's power imbalances, and then there's also peer-to-peer imbalances of power and hierarchy or perceived power or whatever it is. That, you know, some people just like, they want to come to school as a student and not as a racialized body, right? They want to, right. Mm-hmm. They want to just come to school and learn and not have to address or answer to or be made an example of in each of their courses and have to do that work publicly as part of like trying to learn about science writing or trying to learn about, you know, they're like, just teach me the material things. Some people are like that. But I also want that to have space in our courses. And so I do the work by modeling and teach, you know, using some of my own language for concepts that don't have an English cognate. Mm-hmm. And I'll just use it and I'll say, oh, that means that. And I'll say it again. I'll be like, you remember, but. And so I also, you know, I teach in an English department and my English speaking skills are, you know, I'm a heritage speaker of English. Like I can speak English mm-hmm. well. It's my first language, but my grammar sucks and my ability to speak like high English or, you know, concise English or how to pronounce some words, you know, even words I write all the time and can decently spell. Like I get those wrong all the time. And I actually just like mispronounce it and go, I think it's pronounced like that. Like, you know, I don't try to perfect my languaging as a preparation to appear perfected in front of students. So I bring in with me sometimes what we call up in Alaska, like our village grammar, village English grammar, which is influenced by our heritage language in Ubaidun and the way that it's organized and how it has this organized concepts. And so the way I speak in front of students when I'm feeling real comfortable, it's not when I'm, you know, here on a podcast necessarily or whatever, you know, speaking in front of groups, but when I'm feeling comfortable and safe enough to mesh, right? Mm-hmm. To mesh those spaces. I try to achieve that in those rooms so my students can also mesh those spaces. And that for some students includes cursing, you know, because that is a direct way to evoke a feeling or a concept, right? Slang use, I use that a lot, you know? And so I try to like bring in those languages and I don't, you know, exclude them from their written products either as well, because I want them to have freedom of expression. I don't want them to try to find the exact right word and spend all this time trying to find the proper grammar, the proper syntax, the proper everything in order to express their idea. The clarity of how to express ideas comes with practice, but I want them first to have ideas and I don't want to stunt them or stunt that growth of like idea creation because language is hard, you know, and using language in academic spaces, especially English course classrooms, is intimidating. Regardless of your background.
It's interesting that you say, you know, some students just want to be students and not racialized right when they come into the classroom. But I'm sure that you have often students in your class, especially those, you know, that you mentioned social justice focused courses that attract many minoritized groups, that they're also thirsty, you know, for that space where they can be themselves, where they can speak how they speak, express their ideas, how they maybe translanguaging, right, practices. And I share, and it's really an enriching space for everybody. For me, when I have those spaces, and I believe my students, right, where they can just be like, yes, I can, I don't have to explain myself, right? And so I often tell my students, like you mentioned, you know, you bring your heritage language grammar into English, or you know, and that happens, right? So I tell my students sometimes, you know, when I have my bilingual brain, you know, speaking English but in Spanish sometimes, right? Or I tell them that I'm, because of the amount of time that I've lived here in the U.S., I can speak English, I can speak Spanish, but I communicate best when I can use both. So when I translanguage is when I am my full self, you know, that's how I express myself better. And so I think that's all, I do that also as an invitation for them to feel comfortable, right? And to use, you know, the language practices that they use, especially in class discussions when we're, you know, when we're really learning from each other in the classroom. And so I just imagine, you know, your class also being that space where students are like, yes, I can do this here.
I appreciate you saying that. And when you were speaking, it made me think about another part of languaging in a course that is something that I try to make space for, which is, so in my field, technical communication, you know, when it's like professional communications, a lot of times people really like place a lot of value on concision and clarity and correctness. Those are like the three pillars, right. You know, and for me, you know, in a lot of students have a hard time participating orally in class because they are afraid of like rambling a bit to get to their idea. So I ramble a lot to get to my ideas as well, because a lot of times, you know, your mouth is catching up with your brain, you
absolutely.
Know?
Absolutely, yeah.
And you're kind of wandering around an idea you have and getting closer to the center. Mm-hmm. And so I also try to make space for people to practice expressing their ideas. And so I'll hear a long kind of response to something we're talking about in class. And if I'm able to intellectually and cognitively and all that stuff in the moment, you know, because sometimes it gets hard to follow, mm-hmm. but I work hard to try to follow that because I'm trying to do deep listening. And so what I do then is saying, you know, I heard you say, and I'll say it in this way that is like decently concise.
Right, right.
I heard you say this and this, and I really appreciated how you, you know, like really emphasized this. And I was like, did I understand you correctly? And it makes them sound really smart and really like they contributed like a big nugget.
Right, right.
And for me, that has made like allowing for that circumnavigation mm-hmm. around, mm-hmm. You know, around a subject as they're like trying to find the right words for what they're trying to express. And putting together their experiences, like it makes them feel heard. It also clarifies things for everybody else. And then it also shows them, I model to them some maybe field language or maybe, you know, conceptual language that they can then use for that idea again in the future if they so choose. And so in that space, and I know, you know, that's a common teacher tactic, but I think it's something that we don't talk a lot about in the languaging space mm-hmm. is that it takes time and a willingness to be clumsy,
mm-hmm.
to get to idea expression. And I think students they see sometimes a polished version of an idea because they're dealing with subject matter experts mm-hmm. or right. as their instructors. Mm-hmm. And so the bar is really, really high. And so
it's like, listen, you didn't see all the previous edits that I did to this, right?
Exactly. And so like allowing myself to, I don't do a ton of like lecture prep. I have colleagues who spend a ton of time like getting like a lecture script together. I'm like three bullet points. I think I'm going to talk about these three things. And it just comes out how it comes out. And sometimes there's some great nuggets in there. And I will literally stop in what I'm saying and be like, wait, that was a really great nugget. I just want to like pause and say that again, because I think that was like the deep point. And it doesn't come off as like a rambling,
right.
you know, deal, but it comes off as it also invites them into the conversation, right? Mm-hmm. If I'm only lecturing, then there's no space for students. But when I also circumnavigate the idea and get closer and closer, it also allows more contact points
mm-hmm.
for students to hear me in how they language, mm-hmm. right? And how they do that work, because it's a two-part process. It's the comprehension and it's the expression. So
the ability for them to recognize that too signals to them, okay, I need to like answer the question, for example, right? So I think it's fun because as an instructor, you don't think that students are noticing the things that you're doing, and then they repeat, they point it out to you, and you just kind of laugh. How do you feel your own language practices, right? The way that you engage maybe in the classroom or in your writing has informed your work as a decolonial scholar.
My research is currently all about language revitalization and helping to support my community language revitalization because I need it personally. And so I, you know, I've gathered a bunch of resources including, you know, other scholars that have skills that I do not have. And I'm working with a community partner in my region up in Alaska to basically digitize our language in a robust way where we can wind up using a translation service, much like you would use a Google Translate or a Duolingo or those kinds of like language learning process, like a third-party app, and also be able to hear it being said to you, a computerized voice, but we can record elders to make it sound better. And so that is something that is like I deeply need. Because I don't know a word until I hear it. I don't know I know a word until I hear it, you know, because I haven't tagged a lot of meaning to the words that I know. And so I recognize that is like, there's a lot of people, and I have it good for my language group. You know, there's the fluent speakers are in their 70s at this point now, and that's a very small group. And their children, people my age, are no longer speakers. You know, we are people who are either silent speakers, people who, you know, can speak but for some reason have been silenced, and then people who are almost hesitant listeners. Right, where we can, I grew up hearing my language all the time, and then but I would never answer in Ubaytun. I would always answer in English. And so whenever I'm called to today to speak my language, I'm like afraid. I'm like scared. And it's partially because it's a result of colonial violence.
Right.
You know, like I'll explain what I mean by it's a product of colonial violence. There's the obvious things, right? Where, you know, my mom, when she was a young girl, was sent to a residential boarding school in Oregon. And same with her siblings. And, you know, and so she wasn't raised by her mom, but she spoke English at school, but at home they spoke in Ubaytun. And so they stopped learning some of the, you know, the language learning that you do in your adolescence as well, you know, and, you know, complex concepts and how to express that. But also, you know, that same generation, like, went to Vietnam, you know, that same generation were experiencing a form of Jim Crow laws in Alaska, where we were, like, there was a lot of violence against our people in our own homelands. And you know, my mom, you know, part of the schooling in elementary school before they got shipped out, you know, there was physical violence for speaking their language. And the most nefarious ones were that the teachers had the other children harm the other children for speaking their language. So they created like lateral violence where we are harming ourselves.
Right.
And so, and my mom grew up hearing that if you have to teach your children English when you have them, otherwise they won't survive in this world. And she wanted to protect us from the same harm that she experienced. So I have to, like, I've realized as a scholar that it is very complicated, and there, you know, the language experience that I have as somebody who is a language learner today that has lots of experience hearing it, as a scholar, I'm realizing that, you know, inside of my brain, I have sound patterns that I have not signified to an actual definition yet. I know the sound really well. It's like, you know, you recognize a bird song and you're like, I've been hearing that, but I don't know what bird it is. But as soon as you know what bird it is, the name of that bird, you're like, oh, that's the noise, you know, that's the sound of, that's the song of the thing. And so from then on, you're able to pick up that pattern and say, oh, there's this kind of bird nearby or whatever, right? So same thing for me with language acquisition. I have all these dormant sounds inside of me that I know, and I don't know that I know, right? I haven't paid attention well enough. And then as I'm working on language learning, they get tagged and I'm like, wow, I actually knew that. And I'm able to keep it, mm-hmm. you know, like I'm able to keep it a much faster than if it's a totally new concept and word and soundscape, right? Mm-hmm. And so I find that to be really exciting and fascinating as a language learner, because I thought that I had failed myself throughout my childhood, all this time I've had with a fluent speaker and fluent speakers around me. Right. Like, dang it, what did I do? You know? And so, you know, and so, but actually I had been learning. I just had been learning in this roundabout way, kind of like what we were talking about in the classroom, this right. roundabout way. But I also, as a scholar now, who I'm working with fluent speakers and I'm working with dictionaries and I'm working with language resources, there are multiple dialects in our language and their variants, as any language would have, because mm-hmm. languages evolve, right? And they're situated in time and space. Oftentimes, but they also, like with language groups, especially in a language that hasn't been written for a long time, it's like one generation now mm-hmm. it's been written, that there has created we are working on a conflict in our people are working on a conflict related to language. So we have, for, I don't know, like 30 years, our elders have been trying to put out this revision of this dictionary, because, you know, this guy from a mission team had done it, right? And it wasn't exactly correct, mm-hmm. but we were trying to do a revision that is more correct. And that it took 30 years mm-hmm. because we were trying to figure out, like, the right way to do things. And people were, like, working so hard to try to make it correct, mm-hmm. yeah. you know? That it actually stopped. And so people would be like, no, I think there's a, because there's different ways to say it. So trying to agree on the one way or the best way to say something, because our language isn't like word for word with a simple conjugation. It is polysynthetic agglutinal, which it means there's a base and then there's additives at the end. So it's like one word essentially is a whole sentence. Mm-hmm. And so how to express or to say an expression is a little more complicated, because it could be done in different orders and that signifies new meaning. And so as a scholar, I'm recognizing that that as I come into this work, that it's fraught, and that my expectations need to rest with the community. But I also have a stake in it because it's my language too and my birthright. And so having to exert that as a scholar, you know, your own birthright as a scholar is really complicated as in this space. Mm-hmm. So especially as a decolonial scholar, where I'm like, oh, we're going to do this kind of community engagement that is like supports self-determination and sovereignty, mm-hmm. but I'm included in that. And so it's a complicated dance that I've been doing, but it has, for me, it has really led to a lot of forgiveness, because now I understand why when I would try to speak as a younger person that I was scolded so harshly for mm-hmm. for not getting it right, mm-hmm. you know, and it wasn't about me. It was about this process that, like, it was part of this thing of where we are, where the colonial structure of we must document a language because we've stolen it to the point where it's no longer existing outside of documentation, mm-hmm. right? That's not our fault.
Right.
but we're trying to like impose these like hierarchical, these like different kind of structures, mm-hmm. linguistic, you know, whatever categorization mm-hmm. in a language that evolved inside of people and in concert with the land. You know, indigenous scholars often say, or I've heard this said, and I'm blanking on maybe if it was attributed to somebody, but, you know, our languages might go silent, but the land will speak through us again, mm-hmm. and it will come back. Mm-hmm. And that's the hope and the belief. And so for me, I have hope for generations in the future with some of the seeds I'm helping to try to nurture right now. I'm not planting them. I'm nurturing the seeds that are already planted. Right. So that was a long answer to that was a complicated question. So I'll let myself have a long answer.
Yeah, I mean, I think you point out something very important, right? Like the fact that missionaries came to translate or provide the written version of the language within a English language structure, right?
Yeah.
That now the community is trying to retake, regain, and make it culturally relevant and yes. appropriate, right? Not within their own language understanding, right? That's very much this decolonial work that, like you said, I mean, it can be complicated, right? Because of the different variations that exist within a language. I mean, I think of Spanish and Spanish from Mexico, right? The different areas of Mexico or like Spanish from one country to another. And to try to think of like the correct way, right? And so how do we also teach ourselves to be comfortable with nuance, with different ways of saying things, right? Within our own groups and communities. So, I mean, I'm excited about the work that you're doing with language, for sure.
And it's, I mean, right now the elders. Thank you. Right now the elders that you know we're working with are this, you know, the same generation as my mom who went to residential school. So, like. who underwent like violence, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and about their language. And so there's a lot that comes up for anybody in that space. And so it's a really wicked problem. It's one of those wicked problems where there are multiple, I'm going to sound like a scientist, but like variables happening, right? Which are influencing our own ability to be flexible as people using a language right. and trying to understand and learn a language, because there's an urgency to preserve the reality, the historic reality of mm-hmm. the language that was so violently stolen from us.
Yeah.
But there was also this urgency to have our children speak it mm-hmm. again, mm-hmm. to hear our language in play,
mm-hmm.
you know, hear our language in when children are playing pretend,
right.
you know, and to hear that our language in the most innocent form, and be flexible with that. And it's going to be a generational process, and it's scary how quickly it was stolen and mm-hmm. and how much time it takes to rebuild.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Kena, in the last, I don't know, 5-10 years, maybe maybe a little longer, we have been hearing the term decolonial as applied to different practices, including food, beauty, education, and other things. How do you think about this approach in the work that you do, for example, in your research or in the classroom? And how do you, like, it doesn't become just a trend, but actually something that's real and applicable and that students can see, right?
So first off, decoloniality is related to sovereignty.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so it's not exactly the opposite of colonialism; it's actually the partner of sovereignty in my belief. And I wish I had written it like that when I've written about right. decoloniality, because I've seen my own work being weaponized against communities who want to call a project or something that they're trying to do as decolonial because, you know, it is not related to the land, for example, right? Mm-hmm. And that, you know, people get real technical with definitions and they tend to weaponize that. But if I could go back in time, you know, I would say something that was more closely related to, you know, decoloniality is the partner of sovereignty, right? And let that be an interpretive and also a guide for people. It irritates me, you know, when people will tag the simplest action as decolonial. Mm-hmm. Because as somebody who works in this space, it is long and it is like, it is in community. It is like something that is like, is really a dedicated space versus a using of a word accomplishes an action. Mm-hmm. But I'm not about to like argue with people today about what is the right use of it because, it's not that we might be talking about completely different communities. And so what matters to me is that the sovereignty of whatever indigenous or marginalized communities, whatever, is, you know, that have faced the consequences of colonialism and imperialism, that they have this, like, that this work is making space for their self-determination and their sovereignty. Mm-hmm. And that's what I'm advocating for. So, you know, I might use anti-colonial for some things that are more based on, you know, redefining structures that are like colonial structures, but they have nothing to do with my people or, you know, indigenous peoples or whatever it is. Like I might choose to use anti-colonial, but I'm not going to like fight somebody that calls it decolonial. Right. And also I'm not going to fight somebody if they're like saying what you're doing isn't actually decolonial. I'm like, all right, great. Because I'm not going to let, like I said earlier with the elders, right? They fought for 30 years on how to say something, and the task didn't get done.
Right?
Like we just added a new dictionary, and I'm not blaming those elders in right. any way. Like I say that with like deep respect and love, mm-hmm. but there was just a lot of like disagreement happening mm-hmm. that was stopping progress because they were nuancing the word, you know, versus the bigger, bolder thing, which mm-hmm. is making the resource or doing the action that is needed. And so they were so worried about getting it exactly correct that they stalled, that they stopped. And that's the caution I have. So, you know, it's like related to decolonial work, and I work in the Arctic and I work with indigenous communities in the Arctic, mm-hmm. you know, There are words, preferred words for how do we incorporate indigenous knowledges into research, right? Mm-hmm. So some people will say, should we say incorporate? Should we say assimilate? Should we say braiding? Should we say, do you know what I mean? And they're like, they're just worrying so much on the wordplay that they're stopped from doing the there's, you know, and then that's what people focus on. And what I want to say is just like chill, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. like just like try to be like do the work in the community and do the stuff. But like, and if you get it wrong, don't be stopped by the need for perfection. For my own work, I wish I had used different words for certain things. Mm-hmm. I wish I had expressed it. And some of these things are like published last year, mm-hmm. you know, that's okay. But it, like, you know, be humble enough to recognize that you can get it wrong mm-hmm. and that you can be corrected and that you can change it for the next time. Mm-hmm. And so with that, yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be like, oh, they used organic materials and it's now like decolonial lip balm. Like, I don't, you know, I don't want to I'm not there giving permission right. for any of that stuff. Because I can't give permission for anything, you know, because decoloniality is the partner, the sister, the loving cousin, right? The protective auntie and the mutual relation with sovereignty. Mm-hmm. Like sovereignty is really what decoloniality is about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking sometimes those terms, right, that get, or when people get so focused on the right word or something like that. And I think of some of those concepts are undefinable. Is that a word?
Yeah.
For a reason.
Today it is.
Right. That maybe it is an experience, right? So that you can't like put a word to it, but it's actually something that you have to experience, to do, or to see, right? And like I think of the image, you know, and this is talking about language and some of the things that you said and some of the things that our previous speaker from Oaxaca said, you know, and gave us examples of words that don't translate, right? There's no translation for it, right? And so it's an image, it's an experience, right? And she emphasized that, no, this is an experience, right? Which is really hard to put into words. And I think some of this work, while we can maybe approximate, you know, the meaning or the what we're doing in words, maybe we don't fully understand it until we actually are in community, we are in working with the people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I like the experience, and then, you know, like people will talk about it as ways of knowing, mm-hmm. and that there is this very human and interconnected communication that goes beyond words, but we have, is in English is a very complicated series of things like friolenta, right? Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. Yeah. It's just like, but people are like, no, we got like, that's, you know, this person's just cold. They're always freezing. Right. And then in my language, we know we have this one word. It says a lot about the personality, I think, of a culture sometimes too. Like so we have this one word where it's, and we use it all the time in my family. It's a short word. It says adak. It's adak. Adak means basically it's kind of like, what did you expect? Serves you right. Like mm-hmm. you knew better, you know, and you're now coming to me for some kind of like pity or feeling sorry for you. Like you're feeling sorry for yourself because you did this thing that you actually knew was going to be. Yeah. and now you expect me to like console you, you know, that's what that means, that little word. Yeah.
Yes, yes.
It's like, just one of those things.
Right. Kena, you're a member of the Nordvik Native community, and many of your projects focus on the recovery and revitalization of the tribal language. Your work is not only centered on community engagement, but also in digital humanities. Talk to us about why you became interested in this project. And I know that, you know, it's part of also who you are, right? Your language.
Mm-hmm. So the reason I became part of these projects is because part of my attitude as a scholar, or my conviction, my values as a scholar, the things I can control, my values is that I went to my community and I said, I have these skills. Thanks for, you know, supporting me through school. What do you got that needs help with? And so mm-hmm. I'm part of a language revitalization effort because that is the work that was on the table. Mm-hmm. And that is the work, like, it's not an initiative I created. Mm-hmm. It is an initiative the community created. And they said, hey, we've got this going on here. We've got this going on here. You know, what do you think? And I'm like, ah. And so, you know, for myself, I'm like come to understand from another Inupiaq scholar named Margaret Anamuk Rudolph, who's at University of Alaska Fairbanks. She uses this term. She adapts this common term of boundary spanner. Mm-hmm. And so I am fluent in my community's practice and needs and different things like that. And I'm fluent also in academic practices and kind of the ability to like read into what a discipline means and read into like the resources and just, I just get it, you know, like I understand universities and I understand like motivations for research and all that stuff. And so I'm able to hear what my community is expressing as a need and think of potential team members that we might need or skills that we might need in order to meet that need. And so while I did not come up with like, you know what we should do, we should include blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. What I heard from my community is, hey, we have like 2,300 recordings of elders from the 1970s that we digitized. And now we're just sitting on them because they're not, they're all in Inupiatun. And, you know, these are elders speaking in the 70s. These are elders that were children when the first missionaries came, you know, so it's like they're talking about their history and they're talking, you know, it's in 2,300 recordings of it. And, but they're all in Inupiatun. And we have like, we've tried to have our fluent speakers transcribe and translate it. And we spent a few years, a number of years or time doing this, and we've done 300. And it was an excruciating process. And our translators are all retired at this point. And it took so much time and effort. Like, what are we going to do with these 2,000 more that we have just in this one collection, right? There are multiple collections like that. And so, you know, I was able to be like, oh, yeah, that seems like a computational linguistics problem. And that's something that maybe machine learning and AI can help with. And, you know, just I'm just like thinking like of like different technologies that exist today and then how to get a team together to maybe do that. And then how it relates to these other things. And so, you know, how I got involved is because I just listened to the community and I shared what a potential plan could be. And at first they weren't really into it, to be honest, because they're like, machine learning, AI, what the? No, you know, you mean computers are now going to be teaching our language instead of people? People were rightly so concerned. But then with time and community discussion and all that stuff, it's like, we can do this work and we don't even have to use it if we don't want to. Like if you decide it actually is harmful, that's okay. It's your right to say we're not going to turn this into a Google Translate. We're just not, you know, we decided we don't want to do that. Whatever, you know, like exerting their sovereignty, but giving them the option to exert that sovereignty as they, you know, because right now they're imagining a technology versus having it at hand.
Right.
And so, but the other real reason that I do the work the way I do is because my mom taught me to put my people first. Mm. And my mom taught me what a privilege it was to get this education that I have. And my mom convinced me to to go into academia. With my PhD, I wanted to go back home and I wanted to just work for my tribe or Native community, whatever. Mm-hmm. And my mom said, you know, you have these like rich universities that have all these resources that are, want you to like go there. Like, why don't you just go there and like point those resources at our people? Mm-hmm. Just try it for a few years and see how it goes. And, but maybe you can help us.
Right.
And I was like, damn it. And so... And so here I am. Thanks, Mom.
Yes. Kena, what other work or projects are you doing or continuing to do this year? And I'm sure this is one of them, right? It's like an ongoing for the rest of your life project.
Yeah. Right now, like I work a lot with my community partner, Kulluk Trust in Kotzebue, Alaska. And they work on culture, language, and education for like on behalf of the multiple tribes that are in our region. And so I continue to work with them. But one thing that I'm really excited about is the project of my own self trying to work on my language practice, you know, and tying that to cultural practice because it's so embedded. And so, you know, beyond the scholarly work where I'm going to be writing things down or whatever, but the work that is more heart-centered work mm-hmm. versus get tenure and promotion type work is really about, you know, meeting myself, like learning about who I am as a potential speaker and allowing that little girl who was hurt to heal and to move forward in learning her language. And you know, I had this experience recently. I was in Greenland, real far away from where I'm from, you know. But supposedly, you know, their people had migrated from our region in Alaska, like this area that they went across the north. And I could understand a lot of what they were saying. And I was just like, this is so weird that I am in a completely different community, different country, and I can follow subject by subject what these elders or community members or children are saying. And it was gorgeous. I went to the post office in Gangashuswa and I was like buying stamps for these postcards. And it was completely, we didn't use English. I don't speak Danish. So it was like she was speaking in her language and I was answering back in this broken way in mine. Mm-hmm. And we understood each other. And I recently, there's a graduate student in my program at Virginia Tech who is from Sisimiut, Greenland. She just started. And I just saw her the other day and we greeted each other in each of our language and asked each other how we were. And we both understood. And it was just like, whoa, you know, and it was just this like feeling of warmth. And so I'm my project is more of a personal nature, but is to bring that warmth into these spaces with me as much as possible, because I want my work to impact me, sure, as a professional, but mostly I want my work to impact me as a human being.
That's great. Keina, muchas gracias por esta conversación.